This is Brass Tactics, policy and strategy for the people, not the politics.
Welcome to Brass Tactics. As usual, I'm your host, Jonah Giffen, and unfortunately for all of you Maverick Maddies out there, one Peter Mitchell was unavailable to join us tonight due to he's taking some students on a pretty awesome field trip out of town. So instead, I have a much better looking co-host tonight, Grace McGiffin, my better half. Grace, how are you doing tonight?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm great. So did you want to lead us off tonight?
No, you know what? Let's pretend that I know nothing about tonight's topic. And have you lead us off tonight?
Oh, okay. Well, with Pete out of town and nothing super duper novel to talk about in the news this week in terms of foreign policy and strategy, we do have that Hamas video or Hamas podcast we recorded, but I have not finished editing that one. But anyway, so tonight's episode, we were going to do another book review, and just, I'm much happier to record it talking to you than talking to my computer screen, because I had tried that earlier this week and I just wasn't here for it. So the book we're talking about, I've never met anybody else who's actually read it, and I think that's a tragedy. And it's so niche at this point that I only ever heard about it because somebody's writings, this really famous guy, Colin Gray, well, he was famous in the strategic studies community and policy analysis. Really, really smart, bright guy who did a lot for our understanding of foreign policy and conflict. He recently passed away, but I've read almost everything I could get my hands on of his stuff because he's just a really, really persuasive, compelling writer. He mentioned this gentleman in passing, and had he not done that in one or two different articles where he was referencing the founding fathers, as it were, of modern American military and strategy, I would never have come across J.C. Wiley. J.C. Wiley was a retired admiral who took his turn writing at military theory. We've talked about a few of these guys before. Carl von Clausewitz was the most famous. He wrote the big book on war that Pete and I like to argue about.
I was wondering how long
about.
It was going to take you to bring Clausewitz.
Yeah. Oh, this is my opportunity to bash the great Prussian because Pete's not here to defend his honor in absentia. I think Clausewitz is great as long as he's understood in the context of his writing and the context of his spouse publishing his writings after he died without finishing any of it. There was once upon a time this great tradition of academic, scholarly soldier types. They would be the practitioners, the generals in the field, or the generals in the military academy. And they were also the main voices advocating military theory. And I feel like J.C. Wiley was one of the more recent ones, one of the last of them, that really moved the needle in this way. He started writing it in 1953. It was published in 67. And then the last edition was in 89, where he added a few other articles and stuff to it. It was called Military Strategy, A Theory of Power Control. And I think the book, in its own right, is genius, but largely unhelpful, at least to practitioners today. So I think this was a great topic to discuss with you because, as you said, you don't go in for all of this nerdification of warfare kind of stuff or nerdification of strategy. And for the other three people that listen to this podcast, she has not been prepped or briefed on any of this.
Hi, Mom.
But anyway, so before I get into the book, well, I was going to ask you something.
Oh, okay.
how does warfare work? Like, how does one, in your understanding, why does one start a war? How does one finish a war? How do you win?
I don't know. I guess when I think about war, I think of probably World War II, because that's one that I studied a lot in school and somewhat in college. I also think of the Civil War. I studied the Civil War heavily in college. But I think of people standing up for defending those who have been wronged. Like, I mean, clearly Germany was trying to like take over the world and do a lot of bad things to Japan as well. And so it was a combination of effort on behalf of the United States, England, France.
So what you're talking about, the why for that war in particular, the theory of just warfare use ad bellum, something that we mentioned briefly, we'll probably sort of go back to it, but some of the earliest Christian theologians talked a little bit about this. The defense of warfare for war, for just cause, to defend the innocent or to stop evils, stuff along those lines. Yeah, so that is definitely a widely recognized purpose for going to war. But how does war itself work? Is there a formula to it? Does having two armies beat one army? But really, like, how do you win at war?
I don't know. I know the other example I was thinking of was Civil War, and I don't, but in the end, like, the Civil War essentially ended because the South had no more resources. Like, their soldiers were starving or dying. They had, their uniforms were, like, almost non-existent. They had no more resources. So the North, in this kind of won, I almost wonder if they won. I'm sure somebody much more educated than defined this. But I feel it seemed like, in what I was reading about it, it seemed like the North won simply because they had more resources than the South.
You're more right than you know. Generally, wars are fought until somebody runs out of the ability to continue, or sometimes, like with Vietnam, withdrawing because they're no longer interested in war. And so this notion of attrition has been associated with warfare for pretty much as long as people have been studying it. And there's not really, nobody ever felt like there was a need to peel that onion back a little bit further. And that's part of why power control theory just never really took off as a lens for trying to study warfare. Because it's a little bit too general, kind of like saying wars are fought until somebody runs out of money or resources or people. But I think there's a lot of value in there if you just take a step back, because something like power control theory, which I've probably said way too many times without starting to define by now, just helps us frame everything in context and sort of understand why the assumption of attrition has always gone hand in hand with warfare. It's actually kind of ironic because, as we've talked about a couple other times in other episodes, even though warfare pretty much always comes down to attrition, like we even see right now with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, there's always this notion that that won't happen this time. And the Desert Storm or the Gulf War was kind of like enshrined this idea, where if you go in and hit them fast enough and hard enough and violently enough, you can cut it out before the attrition thing sets in.
So would you say humanity is essentially like dumb enough to think like history won't repeat itself? If we just do it different this one time, then surely.
We try to avoid words like dumb enough. We just really try to keep a neutral ground with this podcast, but it's not necessarily a dumb enough thing so much as just too optimistic, right? Because the Desert Storm, if you look at the Gulf War as an isolated conflict rather than a part of a greater phenomenon in the international environment, it did happen that way. It was over really quickly. I want to say the Yom Kippur War, but I'm sure Pete will correct me when he's back in town. But Israel has fought a number of very short, highly intense wars as well in its brief history since the end of World War II. So avoiding this drawn-out war of attrition in theory, is possible. It's just extremely difficult to attain. And when we have seen it attained, it hasn't seemed to be associated with a resolved conflict. While we decisively won against Iraq in Desert Storm in the Gulf War, we were back there again almost a little over a decade later, and we stayed that time for nigh on 20 years. And that brief war I just referenced for Israel, whether it was the Yom Kippur War or the Arab-Israeli War, I honestly do not have Pete's encyclopedic knowledge of wars of history. But that one, like, that did not resolve anything in the area. It had terms associated with the end of it, but it was not the final word in conflict in the Middle East as we currently see right now. So, yeah, I'd avoid saying dumb enough because depending on how you look at the problem, it's entirely possible. If you're looking at it through terms of power control theory, it still might be possible, but it's also very short-sighted. And so my final caveat before I actually stop leading everybody on with this is that power control theory, and the main reason I think it's not really a mainstream theory when it comes to discussing war and warfare, is so general that it couldn't be wrong to begin with. And so in developing theory and testing theories of how the world works, so international relations theories or political science theories, theories have to be able to be disproven. And the more specific your theory is, the less likely it is to be generalized. So Desert Storm, for instance, was won under very specific... I keep saying Desert Storm. It was technically the Gulf War. Desert Storm was the second half of it. But it was won under very specific instances. Like, we had way better stuff than our adversary did. We had way better doctrine. It was never going to be a fair fight to begin with. And so applying that logic that, okay, this worked against the Iraqis at that point in time, this should work again the next time we go to war with anybody, with this air-land battle doctrine as we had at the time. The course of recent history has proven that theory wrong. The doctrine we used at that time, which was generally called the Weinberger-Powell doctrine now, this idea that you can get in there, hit real hard, overwhelming force, and then you can be done with it very quickly. It hasn't panned out. It just hasn't. Because that was just too specific of a scenario to apply this universal panacea we have figured out warfare to. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have power control theory. And power control theory basically says that warfare is characterized by an equilibrium. So you have an aggressor state, usually invading somebody else, whatever. They instigate, catalyze, and make the first move in a war. They're going to have the initiative, and so the war is going to go their way until it doesn't. Once the defending nation gets its act together, it is either going to push back or push against. And as it pushes back and pushes the enemy out of their territory or takes gains back or makes victory, there's going to be this tension, this pressure as the defender pushes against the adversary. And it's going to be a reverse tug of war shoving fight, essentially, until they reach this equilibrium. They're pushing essentially equally, and they stay there until somebody finds a way to undermine that equilibrium. Like your example with the Civil War, undermining that equilibrium came because the South was no longer had the resources to push against. And so they naturally, their lack of resources led to a weakening in their influence. And so they lost some measure of control. And the whole reason that people are fighting is because one state is trying to get some measure of control over the other. Because if you beat somebody else up enough or take enough of their stuff, you can essentially coerce or bully them into doing whatever you want them to do. So the object of warfare is to obtain some sort of measure of control over the enemy. The war itself is going to be played out until it reaches an equilibrium. and it will stay in this equilibrium state until somebody undermines it and seizes the initiative. And then there's a few other assumptions that he throws in here. So despite their best efforts, there may be war. So Wiley sort of predicts war will never go away. And so far, he's not wrong. The pattern of the next war is not predictable with any certainty. This is a fallacy that is often the root cause for a lot of upset and surprise. We assumed that the next pattern of the next war would look a lot like the Gulf War after we won the Gulf War. We thought war was figured out. And since then, especially as we talked about last week with China, it's just not been proven to have been a valid assumption. And then the ultimate determinant in war is the man on the scene with the gun, which is just a really cool way of saying you can't control what actually happens in the war. Like, there's a chance, there's fog of war, there's too many unknowns that play as significant variables in how the war shakes out.
Yeah, not only that, but these wars are being fought by humans, and humans are unpredictable. So I think, I mean, I think that's part of why, like, people keep saying, like, oh, like, they keep trying to build, like, the perfect robot that could fight the wars for us, because then they could control it perfectly. You can't control humans. Like, you can try, but there's always going to be something on the ground in the midst of these battles that are being fought by living, breathing men and women that you can't necessarily plan for. Like, even the best strategists in the world cannot always predict for humanness, I guess.
Yeah. Like I said, it seems like a silly thing to have to say, but at the same time, it's an assumption which time and again seems to have gone overlooked. And so, despite your best efforts, there may be war. The aim of war for all war is to gain some measure of control over the enemy. The pattern of the next war is not predictable with any degree of certainty, and the ultimate determinant in war is always going to be the man on the scene with a gun. There's just four very simple tenets that I think everybody should keep in mind when they're either studying a war or unfortunately having to prepare for the next one. And that's the premise of power control theory right there. And like I said, it seems very commonsensical, very straightforward, and it's very general, which makes it very hard to apply in specific contexts. So it's not always useful to people that are practicing within the community until you forget, you get so wrapped up in the next big widget or like that perfect warfighting robot, like you just alluded to, that you kind of forget some of the most basic fundamental tenets or principles of warfare. And so that's power control theory in a nutshell. But the book, it's such a small book, and it's just so perfect for what it does too. Because he lays out power control theory, but what else he also does is he gives a really insightful recap, basically, of how different theorists from different walks of war have looked at warfare. Because what he did when he went to write this book, his purpose was to find a unifying theory, because every other theory of war we had up until this point had been based off of domains specifically. So like continental theory refers to armies, the land domain. Maritime theory refers to naval sea power, so the sea domain. Air power is air power theory. And so each practitioner approached the study of war in a very exclusionary way. They only looked at their thing. So what Clausewitz discusses is great, but it's also pretty much exclusive to land battle. And so Clausewitz says, like, the destruction of the enemy force, the destruction of the enemy country's land, or the destruction of the enemy's will to fight are one of those three things, ideally all three of those things, but you need to accomplish at least one of those things in order to win a war.
Can I ask really quickly, when was the last time a war was actually fought exclusively on land? Like in history, when was the last time that would have happened?
I think a lot of people would argue that the Gulf War was mainly land, but it was using air power. So there was this combined air-land power doctrine. But World War II was the last one where you saw air, land, and sea assets all employed in, like, the same battlefield.
Right.
Right. So, because what has usually happened in wars up until this point is that the Navy did its thing, and then the armies did their thing. And then when there was some coastal action, they worked together sometimes.
I see.
So, like, the invasion of Normandy, for instance,
mm-hmm.
there was a very small number of noticeable joint is what the word is used in the community. When you have your Army and Navy, or Army, Navy, Air Force all working together, you call that a joint operation. And that was really the exception and not the rule. And so the developing all of these domain-based theories was understandable, because the Navy was the only thing in the sea until World War II, when you started packing your own air support along with your navies. That's really what starts breaking some of this stuff down. But yeah, so he gives a brief summary of continental theory, what Clausewitz says, what Antoine de Jomini says. They're looking at these theaters of warfare, these campaigns and these battles. They're not looking at when they use the word strategy, it's not the same way that Air Force people and naval people use the word strategy at all. A strategy is something very high level, that helps shape multiple operational campaigns and things like that. And everything else below that tends to be some sort of operation, some sort of campaign, or some use of tactics. Whereas, like Alfred Thayer Mahan, who we talked about briefly in the first couple of episodes, he's one of the more famous naval theory guys, and he defines strategy as everything that happens in war until you make contact with the enemy. And while you're in contact with the enemy, that is when you are using tactics. And so strategy is this more pervasive, all-encompassing thing in war, whereas where the continental theory with the ground pounders, they're like, nah, strategy is something that people way in the back do. It has nothing to do with the actual war fighting that happens up here. And so he's looking at all of these different perspectives, and he's trying to develop this theory that ends up being power control theory that unifies them all together. And so when you look at maritime theory in this context, so you have continental theory, and continental theory is very much about controlling land, defeating armies, or making the other actors, people give up, right? These other theories all relate back to the land, which implies that the land part is the most important part. And it is, but mainly because the land plays the most central part in attritional warfare. All of your resources are on the land. Like, your people can't not live on land.
Right.
Right. So as I've told some of my classes before, until we figure out how to colonize Mars or build viable, livable space-based habitats, all warfare is going to be about breaking the equilibrium, and breaking the equilibrium will always happen on the land. So, put another way, we are not going to get rid of trench warfare anytime soon, and it was kind of short-sighted to think that we would.
Trench warfare meaning like digging literal, like in World War II, like digging literal trenches and like throwing bombs at each other type thing.
Yep. Like,
okay.
Really, World War I, I think, is more characterized by that. And then World War II is a lot more dynamic. But the Russia-Ukraine war has returned back to people throwing artillery fire at each other and digging trenches.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah. This is part of why we started Brass Tactics, because a lot of this stuff just doesn't make it back to anybody anywhere. But yeah, so field artillery and trench warfare is not going anywhere, because they literally are the quintessential equilibrium, the quintessential stalemate in the middle of a war.
Right.
There's nothing more visceral than that. And so to break this equilibrium, you need to cheat. You need to leverage some new advantage. So you're either stuck waiting until somebody runs out of resources, or you have to cheat. And the way you cheat is by exploiting new domains. So instead of being stuck in only trench warfare, right? You find some way to exploit. You first get control of the sea is what maritime theory is all about, establishing command and control of the sea.
Okay.
Where you cannot just uniformly command everything on the sea. You have to be able to control the sea in strategic locations for long enough to exploit that control. So you control the sea not to just control the sea. You control the sea in order to exploit the sea against your enemy, generally based on the land. Like blockading somebody, choking them off to cut off their resources. That's the most quintessential.
Like when,
but you can also
a castle almost.
Exactly. Or you can conduct an amphibious assault. Once you have defeated all of your enemy's subs or anything else that they can blow up your transport ships with, you can bring your marines and land them on the beach. And you have now opened up a completely new side of the war for the enemy's army. So now the enemy's army has to spread itself thinner in order to defend against you. And this logic is preserved through air power theory too, although air theory is basically offensive only. So you can skip past the enemy's army and go blow up their factories in the back with your bomber fleet. You can blow up their communication systems, find where their computers are talking to satellites and neutralize those. Or you can fly close air support directly over your army and give them even more firepower. And all of that requires you to be able to control the airspace above the battle. So land is not just the continental theory is not just about controlling the land. You can destroy everybody's stuff on the land, or you can destroy the army to be able to march into the enemy's territory, or you can break their will to fight. Air power theory likes to think that it can break their will to fight, but that's just historically not something we've seen happen. Air power theory is about controlling the air so that you can do something to the land.
Right.
And naval theory is the same. And as we develop cyberspace theory, I think you will see this similar thing where cyberspace theory will dictate that you need some measure of control over cyberspace in order to leverage that control into actions in these other domains.
Cyberspace, you're talking about computers then.
Yeah, the interwebs and all that stuff that you can't see.
So that would be something else to take into consideration?
Absolutely. Any new dimension that you can conceive and operate in is a new way you can cheat at warfare and get leverage over your enemy to avoid this all-encompassing bugaboo, this equilibrium that happens inevitably in warfare.
Okay, so I'm thinking of it. I'm a visual learner, so I'm trying to picture how this would work. And what?
That's sort of a supreme irony because you're on a podcast right now that doesn't record video.
Yeah, well, you know. And so what I'm picturing is actually a scene from that TV show we were watching last night where the good guys get hacked, essentially. And like they were fed false data, like through their computers, like they were like they made profiles about these people, but it turned out the information that made these profiles was completely wrong. So they were like they actually knew nothing. They thought they knew everything about these people, but it turns out they knew absolutely nothing. So would that be an example, I guess, like of the cyberspace that you're talking about? Like,
yeah,
battling through, I guess, computers.
You cheated and created bad information,
mm-hmm.
which the other guys then used in their strategy,
right?
Which made their whole plan of attack completely useless.
Okay,
it's basically a very elaborate ambush they set up by messing around in cyberspace.
So, I mean, would it be not safe, maybe, but reasonable to say that using cyberspace, essentially hacking, like you're just hacking back and forth, like across, like instead of shooting guns at each other across land, you're hacking each other across computers until somebody outsmarts the other? Like, obviously this wouldn't be the only thing being done in a war, but it would be like a large part of it.
Yeah. So 10 years or so ago, really smart guy named Thomas Ridd wrote a book that kind of explains itself in the title. It was called Cyber War Will Not Take Place.
Okay.
And his main point was that, yes, you can technically attack somebody through cyberspace, but you can only do so much damage on the internet.
Right.
Which, at the time, it was true. There was very limited examples of what you could do. But now, like, the entire stock market is digital, which makes it vulnerable to cyber attack. We've seen gas pipelines get hacked, right? So I don't know where the line is between shutting something down and then forcing something into some sort of self-destruct error state, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that Thomas Ridd's conclusion is as certain as he made it seem. But ultimately, nothing you do in cyberspace alone is of inherent value. It has to be translated into tangible effects. And those tangible effects ultimately have to make their way back to where the people are, where the state is, which is on the land. And so you can control the flow of information in cyberspace. And that would make you extremely well insulated, well protected if you can do that. Now, if you can control your adversary's cyberspace, that would make your adversary extremely vulnerable. You could shut down their computers, right?
Mm.
If you shut down their computers, it's going to shut down large swaths of their economy and also probably of their defense structure, since their defense structure would have to be forced onto an analog system, and analog systems are just generally much slower than digital ones. So you're translating your control of cyberspace into outputs, into the actual physical war itself.
Well, I think that's especially relevant today and will probably grow in relevancy in the future because, I mean, in today's day and age, like, the social media is hugely prevalent in so many people's lives. And like you're saying, like, oh, these things will have to, you know, translate into the real world. And I feel like we see that a lot, just like, I mean, an example for me would be like cancel culture, you know, and that's not obviously as serious as warfare, but it kind of on a like a much lower level, people say things on the internet and then they have real world consequences of, you know, I don't know if getting canceled is necessarily like a consequence per se. But, you know, you say something on the internet and it could translate into like very serious consequences. Like if you said something or did something that was actually legitimately criminal, you could get arrested for it in the real world. So I feel like talking about cyberspace, like that will be probably grow to be a big part of warfare in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people would argue that it already is.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, Russia pulled a lot of information operational shenanigans. And even at the start of this current conflict, they definitely did it as well. And again, as I would argue, this all goes to illustrate power control theory. Anytime you open up a new domain, ultimately, you can expect that new domain to be fought over so that somebody can control it or can control key parts of it so that they can exploit it in warfare against somebody else.
Right.
So it was very easy to see this happen with naval power and with air power. And I think cyber power really caught people off guard. It really caught people off guard. But maybe it shouldn't have. And so that's my two cents on J.C. Wiley and military strategy, a theory of power control. I think it's extremely valuable as the first book people ought to read if they want to understand military theory and if they want to understand the general mechanics of warfare. And then, yeah, I think people pretty much graduate past it almost immediately, but it is just in its virtue is in its simplicity. So you can't really use it for everything. And it's not the most informative lens to look at warfare through just because it doesn't really say anything meaningful in particular that helps us predict how to use strategy, but it lays out some fundamental truths that I think go overlooked far too often.
Well, good to know. I'll add it to my reading list.
Ba-da-ba-ba-da-bop. Well, Grace, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was my pleasure.
And for all of our two loyal fans out there, go tell two other people about us. Let them know we're here. Follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Google Podcasts is turning into YouTube Music, and I haven't had the wherewithal to figure out how to get my stuff translated onto YouTube Music, but send us a note. Let us know you appreciate what we're doing. Tell your friends' friends. Make your wives, make your husbands listen to it. Just, yeah. Spread the word. Have a good day.